Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 133 of In Tech We Trust. I'm Yadin Porter de Leon at Porter de Leon on Twitter. And in this episode, we explore who's using the latest and greatest software tools and who isn't.
People in the Valley talk a lot sometimes about how, let's talk about how to deploy Kubernetes and orchestrate containers and build microservices. Large swath of the country, they're still trying to figure out what containers is.
Also, software innovation is fantastic for enterprise companies as long as nothing breaks.
There's still now a trade-off of you're saying, I'm getting the software, but that's, you're just getting the bits, right? So then it's the day two, what happens after that? So now I'm running it. How do I do upgrades? What happens if something breaks? Do I have to try and find a patch and wait for it to be released and then apply it? And what happens if that breaks something?
And then we discuss some ways in which you can get started with contributing to the coding community.
It's a daunting task when you are especially getting started, I think, in the development world. Maybe you're an ops person, or maybe you're just getting started out early in career, to go through someone else's code and have the audacity to, you know, make bug submissions and try and make commits and whatnot, depending on how truly open it is. But to go through the documentation, I think, is probably a great way to learn. But also, I think documentation in any sort of tech-related thing, product or solution, is always severely lacking. I mean, point me to a good documentation site and, you know, well, just good luck.
So, this is it. The last episode of In Tech We Trust with me at the helm. For those of you who have enjoyed this new format and want to hear more in-depth and personal stories about people in their tech careers so that maybe, just maybe, you can move forward in your own, please join Lauren Malhoit and I on our new show, The Tech Village. So please, head on over to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or the podcatcher of your choice and subscribe to The Tech Village podcast or follow us on Twitter at Tech Village Pod. And with that, let's get the show started.
In Tech We Trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
First, we're joined by Ken Hoy at Ken Hoy New York, that's NY, on Twitter, technical marketing engineer at Rackspace, to talk about open source technology. Ken, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
So Ken, this is something I'm really fascinated with and really excited about, which is open source. And open source as a technology and where it's at, not only in its maturity level from, let's say, a community standpoint, but also from an adoption standpoint. Where are you seeing open source success stories in the enterprise right now, based on, and there's a lot of stuff out there. There's Kubernetes, there's open source, there's OpenStack. Where are you seeing the real good uptick is in technology and in the enterprise?
Yeah, that's a great question. So just give a little background. I've been in the OpenStack space for a while and have a lot of interactions with people in the Valley, but I'm also based in New York. So I talk to a lot of customers on the East Coast.
And you definitely... Everything's not the same in the Valley. The Valley's not represented.
It's amazing. That divide that people talk about actually do exist. I know sometimes when I go to a Valley, a good example is I went to a Docker meetup in San Francisco. And, you know, Docker is obviously a very hot open source technology and has been for a few years. Someone asked the typical, how many of you are deploying Docker? And out of a room of 250 people, probably about 80% raised their hands. I go to the same Docker meetup in New York, for example, when you may have 100 some people show up and 10% of the hands will go up.
Yeah, it's a stark contrast.
Very stark. So yes, I think a lot of the things get hot on the Valley, on the West Coast, but they make their way very slowly across the rest of the country. So I think whereas people in the Valley talk a lot sometimes about how, let's talk about how to deploy Kubernetes and orchestrate containers and build microservices. Large swath of the country, they're still trying to figure out what containers is and figure out how they would actually use it.
So what do you think some of the most powerful trends are driving open source right now? And what's what you're seeing the most success with. I know you got a lot of visibility across a lot of these open source technologies. Where are you seeing, from an enterprise perspective, where the future is in the success of these open source projects that are now being productized?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things have been very attractive, I think, for enterprises is that, one, to be honest, is not having is cost savings, or at least perceived cost savings on not having to pay a license to a particular vendor, in that sense, be locked in to that vendor. I think also, I think people view that a lot of the biggest innovations are actually in the open source space. You know, before, if you had a vendor, you would make a request and it may take a year or more for your feature request to actually make it in. Now, in the open source world, especially if you're willing to have some engineers work on it, you could have your feature request make it into the next release in a couple of months. So I think that's driving a lot of the interest in open source. I think what's interesting, though, is in the enterprise is sometimes we underestimate the importance of relationships.
I think that's a key point.
Yeah. So what I find, for example, is that although a lot of the kind of new and upcoming vendors are the ones doing a lot with open source, still a lot of people in enterprise wait until their trusted vendors are doing something with that technology before they move on. A good example is in the Kubernetes space, where you know you're starting to see some different Kubernetes vendors like CoreOS come out, but in a lot of cases, things didn't start really getting explored until Red Hat pivoted with OpenShift to support Kubernetes as a container management system, and that's gotten more. That's driving more interest because enterprises trust Red Hat.
So I think maturity is a huge component of an open source technology project and the productization of that technology. You underscored something that is critical with enterprises. When they're buying something, they need, even more so than the technology, they need to know that they've got the people and the company that are going to stand behind that technology and make sure that it's, you know, patched and updated and upgraded, and then they've got people there. And so those trusted relationships are built over time. So as cool as this new technology is and how hot it is, you know, or how hot we think it is in the Valley, it's really about a company trusting another company, or really people trusting other people. And that maturity of that product or project plays into that a lot. From a maturity standpoint, do you feel like Kubernetes is there? Do you feel like OpenStack is there?
Maturity is always a tricky term, I think, especially in open source world. And by that, what I mean is, I think most people view maturity or equate maturity with stability and deployability and supportability. And there's some element to that. But if you think about it, why do people, going back to the Red Hat use case or even a company like SUSE or Canonical, why do people pay support subscription? I think most people would say that as an open source project, Linux is about as mature as it gets. And I think the reason is, at the end of the day, an open source project also wants to do innovation. And so there is a balance that has to be achieved. And what companies, enterprises value is a company that says, I'll take that open source technology, however mature it may be, and really hone down on it and make it what they would consider enterprise grade. So where the stability is actually sometimes much more important than the innovation. So I would say, when you ask if OpenStack or Kubernetes is mature, I would say they've come a long way. But I think in a lot of cases, you still need a company that stands behind them to make them supportable and enterprise consumable.
Yeah, and so that maturity really goes to your point, Ken, which you have stability of the product, like deployability, and then you also have the stability of the company. And from an enterprise perspective, you know, I think the takeaway from what you're saying is, it sounds like that stability of the company in many cases is much even more so important than the stability of the actual product.
Yeah, I mean, no one wants to be the one holding the bag, right? If a company disappears.
Yeah.
and there's always, I mean, I've been part of end user companies where, you know, there was a niche technology, not even open source, just proprietary, and then the company disappears.
Yeah.
And now, you know, no one's patching it. No one's, or you're responsible trying to figure out how to patch it. So,
yeah. Or like, no one wants that. Open source project and somebody deploys it in production because it's really cool and it does this cool thing. But then all of a sudden, like 5 years later, you know, that was just, you know, some student in Sweden, you know, was maintaining, and they just stopped because they went off and did something else, and now this company is like relying on this one component that's no longer patched or upgraded, and they've got to like figure out, okay, what's to do now. You want that, you know, not just that mature company you want, but you also want that one, you know, throat to choke, as they say, to be able to go to a vendor right. that's longstanding and be able to say, hey, look, you know, you need to make this right. And I think even more so, I mean, especially I've been, you know, on the enterprise company side in buying, and you really want that assurance that they're going to be around to fix it if something goes wrong. Because as we know, software, something always goes wrong.
Yes.
So were you excited about, from a technology perspective, because you're a technologist. You've been around the open source, you know, technology field for a long time. Were you most excited about, I'd say, the value for large companies or even mid-sized companies for some of these open source projects, you know, looking, you know, I think maybe doing some crystal ball gazing and looking at the horizon. Were you most excited about the future in the data center for some of these open source projects?
So actually, I would put it this way. I actually think the most exciting things to happen are not things that are going to happen in customer data centers.
Interesting.
I think public cloud is actually, I don't want to, you know, I don't know if I'm of the mind that, you know, public cloud would take over the entire world and, you know, there'll be five companies running data centers.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to happen. I think there will always be a need for on-premises technology. But I think the most exciting things are going to be happening in the public cloud space. And I think particularly of serverless technology or function as a service, just because I think it has the potential to really change not only from a technology standpoint, from an economic standpoint, how people deploy applications, right? Which is at the end of the day is what it's all about.
Let me unpack that, because one, I mean, you can give a quick explanation of serverless. And then talk about sort of the open source components that you feel are really driving that and why it's so exciting to you.
Yeah, so the term serverless is actually probably not the best term in the world. And a lot of people have pointed that out. Because, you know, obviously code always runs on something.
Yeah, got to run something.
I think serverless is kind of the ultimate instantiation of, hey, you don't have to worry about infrastructure at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's a dramatic shift. So you're not provisioning resources, even if they're cloud resources that could be scaled up, scaled down. You're really just focusing on the core functions or resources needed by the code. So it's more of a like resource consumption based computing model instead of general sort of public cloud or platform as a service.
Surprisingly large number of people who want to treat their container like it's another virtual machine. Like literally they take their entire virtual machine and port it over to a container, and you get like a, you know, 100 gigabyte container image. And that's just because they want to carry that old way of doing things, right, over to the container space. Can't really do that. I mean, you can't do that in a serverless environment. You literally have to change everything, the whole way you think about how to consume that resource.
So Ken, I think this is really fascinating. Just to wrap up, you see serverless as the future. Where do you think if you had to pick one project, one technology, where do you think the winner is going to be in the next 2-3 years in sort of the enterprise or in the cloud, I should say in the cloud?
I kind of think of it in two ways. I think in the public cloud space, which I think will eventually be the big winner, I think it's AWS and Azure. With Google kind of coming up, but I think not for a number of years. I think even Diane Greene has said it'll take 5 years for them to catch up to AWS. I think in terms of on-premises technology, this may be a little controversial. I actually don't think serverless makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah.
So I think containers, and I think specifically Kubernetes, looks like it will be the winner. But that's important because I think, harking back to what I said before, even though I think serverless is the future, it's going to take a while. It might still take a while for it to filter across, right, to the rest of the country and the rest of the U.S. and the rest of the world. So on-premises technology will be still very important. I think containers will eventually, with Kubernetes, will eventually be the dominant player in the on-premises technologies.
Well, Ken, I love the perspective, and thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Next, I had the chance to talk to Tyler Britton, who's a part of the OpenShift team at Red Hat, about open source business models, how companies can make money with open source, and how does this open source trend affect the businesses that actually consume the services and software. Tyler, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, Tyler, just to give some context, can you give us a quick thumbnail sketch of what OpenShift is?
So OpenShift is a container platform that Red Hat has. We offered a bunch of flavors where we call online, which is like our public cloud. Then we have a dedicated, which is managed, and then a the typical Red Hat software subscription where you can install it wherever you want. And it's based on kind of the industry standard Kubernetes and Docker and OCI and all those that good stuff.
Now I'm really fascinated by open source and this specific focus on open source, which is business models, how people make money, is most fascinating to me. So I'm excited about getting into this. I was just reading an article on NoJitter talking about, is there life after open source? And very clickbaity title, but the subject really kind of brings across the point that enterprises could buy closed source software with support contracts, etc., or they could buy a shiny box for for commoditized hardware, and pay X number of dollars with enterprise license agreement, etc. Or they could get a commoditized product as sort of a fraction of the price. And so I think that first thing is around commoditization. And do you think that's sort of a false argument when talking about the dangers of open source or how open source might affect the closed source software community? Could you maybe kind of talk about that commoditization trend and whether you think that's that's a good way to pursue an open source business model, or is that really just not capturing the market that you want to capture?
Well, I think what's interesting about it is if you really think about what's happening with open source and kind of there's a lot of pieces to it. There's really a lot of different factions. We have the traditional all software should be free, kind of people, and then there's the open source is a good way, a good model to develop software. And I think in the latter, if you think about something like, say you're some giant, Fortune 50 company, and you're looking for a new ERP system, so you bring in Oracle and SAP and a bunch of closed source proprietary software vendors, and you're gonna make probably a $50 million software purchase. When it comes down to the end, you're building your typical charts and figuring out who has the advantages where and based on your business, you're probably making the decision based on less than 10% of the code, right? A lot of the other stuff is just table stakes, like, hey, it does, balances and ledgers and it does all these other things. Well, if you think about it, all those companies have, armies of software engineers writing that stuff. That's all the same. So think about how much wasted energy they're putting into it, and then now as an end consumer, you're buying it. A big piece of your chunk of the cost you're paying for it is paying for that development that's totally redundant. So I mean, in a perfect world, you'd say, hey, well, let's just all collaborate together on the kind of table stakes parts of software, and we'll do it in an open manner, and then we'll just build our what we see as our niche specialty value add stuff. We'll focus there, and that way we can cut our costs down, and then when we go to market to the end consumer, their costs are lower too. So I mean that's in a perfect world, and what we see more of is a closed source versus open source, as totally separate methodologies.
And I think that's a fantastic way of actually framing. Instead of talking about commoditization, you're actually talking about efficiency. Instead of having 10 different competing companies, all with armies of developers creating the same exact software, but just packaged in different ways with sales teams just trying to sort of sell that, you actually have one source of truth, one bit code base that everyone then creates differentiated products and services off of, and you cut a lot of that redundancy. So it's maybe, if you're looking at it from a cost perspective as a business model, you're really more looking at it as efficiency and not commoditization. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's efficiency through commoditization, right? You're saying that part of the software is a commodity at this point. Everyone in the market needs that section of the software. So why would we, reinvent the wheel? Even if you look at something simple as people writing, writing web apps, they use Node.js or whatever, and they use all these different frameworks and things like that because there's no value for them writing their own web framework. They say, well, we're going to start here because there's no value, and then we're going to build our valuable thing on top of it. So I think that's kind of the mindset, and I think it's still highly destructive to the software industry as in general from traditional models as these changes take place. And I think the topic always comes up whenever you talk about making money in open source software. Everyone says, there's no way, nobody makes any money in open source software, then there's an asterisk, except Red Hat.
And let's talk about that. I mean, Red Hat is one of those. And then you have other companies. I mean, Pivotal went from zero to $270 million in revenue. And they have a unique business model that's really sort of based on not commoditizations, more about basing, you know, on like a trend. Miranta is another one. I mean, that's a really heavily, you know, professional services. But getting away from professional services and really talking about actual software sales, I mean, Red Hat is huge, and they caught. I mean, there was a move from Unix to Linux, which Red Hat caught. That was a huge trend. But now we're having a microservices trend, you know, which to your particular group and the OpenShift project, microservices and containers is a massive, massive trend shift, and the cloud. Which is one thing that Pivotal, or a couple of things that Pivotal is actually writing right now. Maybe you could talk about that. Which companies are currently successful right now, and how are they riding that sort of the microservices and containers trend? And do you need that trend, you know, to really push an open source project or an open source company, I should say?
Well, I think it's one of the things is companies struggled to copy Red Hat. You know, Red Hat's model. You know, when you're talking now, you're talking about, you know, Red Hat's. You're talking billions of dollars in software subscriptions. You know, kind of the joke of being Red Hat's, you know, making billions selling free software. And then you mentioned some other ones like Pivotal and everything like that. I think the trend you're starting to see now is companies are realizing that either they can't be total purists. So like Pivotal, you know, is heavily involved in open source, but a lot of their end products have some proprietary components in it. And their idea is, hey, well, we're not going to, you know, we're not all about purity here. We're all about building stuff that businesses want, right? And I think that's a pretty attractive model. I think the big thing is if you think about Red Hat's really trading on its name, right? So you're paying, you know, you can get the software for free. The reason you're paying Red Hat a subscription is for support, both from updates and bug fixes and patches and those type of things, but, you know, someone on the other end of the phone or email to help you through it, which is really important to enterprises. I think that model is, you know, it's tough for a new company. You know, if you're a startup, then you're doing some new container thing built on Kubernetes to get someone to be like, here, trust me, give me your money. You know, we're going to be around a while to take care of this for you. But I think the big mistake personally that I see open source that Red Hat didn't make, and I, like you said, there's so many other pieces to it. What hot trend did you get in on and things like that? It's hard to boil these things down to one thing. But I think one thing I noticed is the model of we'll give it away for free at the beginning. We'll get people to use it a lot, and then we'll come up with like in a premium version we'll charge for, and everyone will move to the premium one. And I think we've seen that fail a lot because people get comfortable with the free one, and they're okay with, oh, there's a couple extra little new features. Well, we don't really care about that, like, and we're not paying for it. I think you're seeing that even with like Docker. Everyone uses Docker, and nobody pays for it.
That's an interesting point with Docker as well. I mean, because so many companies got burned with that model. They're like, well, let's have a base model, or let's cater to the users instead of the real big enterprises that we really need to sell these large contracts to. And said, okay, well, here's this free version, or there's this freemium model, and that freemium model really doesn't work with open source. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think if you do it at the same time, so you say like, here's our thing, and then here's the pay thing, like right out of the gate. People can, you know, make those, this, you know, hey, I'm really new to this. Yes, I do want support. I want all this. But if you say like, hey, we're going to throw the free thing out there for a year or two, wait for it to get traction, then we're going to have a pay thing. I think that's where you see a lot of challenges around the open source model.
And so there's some other companies that are kind of on the horizon, like Platform 9, that is really packaging up open source software and delivering it as a service. And I think that's one of the differentiators that you had alluded to, which is when you've got something that you've got one source of code, what are you going to do with, you know, what's the closed source component of that you're really selling to the enterprise, in addition to selling that sort of that trust, that army of developers, the people who are there, going to be there to take care of you. And maybe it's a combination of those two. And maybe your perspective would be good on this. Is it one thing you really want is you want to build that trust. So Red Hat's got that trust. It's got the trust of the enterprise. And that's the big thing I think you're selling. But you also have to have that closed source differentiation that is supported by that army of developers that you know you're continually going to have all the patches, the bug fixes, the latest UI updates, all of that stuff. Is it a combination of two, or is there anything else other than those two things that you really need to have when you're an open source company to really be successful?
Well, I think it's sort of like knobs that you turn, you know, for those two. So like for Red Hat, there is no closed source, there is no proprietary. So literally yes, we're giving you a pipeline to get those things like updates and stuff, but all the code is freely available, you know. So we don't do kind of the what you would call the open core model, which is, you know, the core piece is some open source project, and then we do our proprietary stuff on it. So we have to trade much more on our reputation and support. Whereas if, like you said, if you're a, you know, Pivotal or someone else who's doing some more of an open core model, if your proprietary whiz bang on top of it is, you know, makes that much of a difference, your name isn't as important. You could be a new company coming into it. They're like, wow, they took, you know, whatever project, you know, fun, you know, Kubernetes, whatever, and then they did this crazy thing to it, and it's popular. You know, if they added some support for some, you know, platform people really wanted or something like that, I think that's an option. And I think you hit on that with Platform 9 is consumption of open source is still a business. You know, so like you said, I don't know if you've seen recently, Amazon's been doing a lot more to contribute back to open source. And people are like, wow, Amazon's getting involved in open source. It's like, yes, on the production side, you know, or contributing side, they're a massive consumer of open source. They use so many open source, you know, components in building their service. The reason they don't have to contribute it back is because they're not distributing it to customers. They're consuming it and then providing a service. So yes, under the covers, there's a ton of open source projects. Obviously, they have their own custom code there too. But that's another model to say like, hey, we're going to consume, say, Kubernetes or OpenStack from the community, and then we're going to build an offering based on it. And the customers may or may not care that it's built on that technology, and that's up to you to decide if you're going to expose that to them.
Let me ask one final question for you, because this question fascinates me, and it's on one of the points you mentioned with regards to how, you know, there's the open core model, and there's the way in which enterprises could basically download all of the code. There's none of the, you know, the closed source UI or closed source components to it. And so what's stopping large enterprise from just going and downloading it and running it themselves? Why are they handing those checks over for, like, you know, a $10 million transaction for a piece of software that they could download themselves?
You know, it's it's that overall support. So there's still now a trade-off of you're saying I'm getting the software, but that's, you're just getting the bits. Right. So then it's the day two. What happens after that? So now I'm running it. How do I do upgrades? What happens if something breaks? Do I have to try and find a patch and wait for it to be released and then apply it? And what happens if that breaks something? And, you know, you say like, well, then you can may have extra people. So like big, really large companies, especially like, say, for example, the telco space that are operating their own OpenStack environments, using some of them even, you know, just trunk code off GitHub. Because they have an entire extra staff to do that work and contribute back, you know, the AT&Ts and Comcast and those. And I think that's the enterprise says, like, look, we need this capability for our developers, but we don't want to be in this business. So we'd rather just cut you a check every year to support, to basically take the place of those bodies we would have to hire and pay to kind of do that extra work.
No, I think that's an excellent analogy, because in my head right now I'm going, okay, I'm a VP of IT or a CTO or something like that, and I'm in a boardroom and they're like, oh, well, we've got all these servers. We have a CTO right over there. Why don't we just give them to him? Why do we need to hire all these people for the data center? Let's just have the CTO go in and just rack and stack and cable and all that stuff. And the CTO will go like, that's because I'm not doing that. That's what those people I'm going to hire are going to be for. But maybe that's the advantage of something like a Red Hat. And I think a lot of people already know the answer to this question because they're consumers of Red Hat. But it really is that trust, that knowledge that you have the people, the resources behind the technology, and it's just going to run. You basically can just consume it. You're like, I want to consume it. I don't want to build it myself. I want to work on, I'm an insurance company, or I'm a bank, or, you know, I'm a lumber company or something like that. I want to consume that component of the thing I need my business to run. I don't want to be in that technology business as a different business. It's not my differentiator.
And I think where the legacy of that comes in too is one of those things is like, hey, we've been working with Red Hat, you know, say with Linux for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. You guys kind of understand what we need and kind of like what we consider something to be stable. Because, you know, it's like, oh, Kubernetes 1.6 came out and it has XYZ feature. Like, let's turn that on. You know, like, that's not really ready for you. You know, like, yes, someone in a startup may consider that, you know, good enough, but they're still missing pieces, or, you know, those types of things. And then a big value of open source, right, is if you control the direction, anyone can contribute to it to control the direction. So that's the other thing is if you're a big enterprise and you're like, well, I'm going to consume Kubernetes or OpenStack or whatever, you're like, well, I kind of wish it did this. You know, you have someone you can go to be like, hey, Red Hat, can you make it do this? And then especially if enough enterprise customers come, it's like, we can totally make it do that. We're going to contribute that code upstream on your behalf so that it's all in there. So I think it's those types of pieces that really like, hey, you guys understand our business and kind of what we think is acceptable level of before we would put something in production. So we're expecting you to take those, you know, kind of wily upstream bits and smooth the edges off before we get it.
No, I think both those are really great points because I've personally had experiences with, you know, talking to someone like Oracle and say, hey, Oracle, you know that BDB product you have? Can you make this small little tweak because in production this is happening, that's happening. They're like, yeah, here's your number. Your number 147,275, and we'll get to you sometime next quarter of the year 2078. and then the other piece, which is like, let's just, you know, some people are like, well, if you're running OpenStack, you got to run Trunk. You know, we're running Trunk. It's like, great, you're right on the bleeding edge, fantastic. But you know what? I want to go with Platform 9. They just wrap it in a SaaS service. I don't care if they're two distros behind, you know, what the latest one is. I know that it's going to work. And when I go there, it's going to be there and it's going to be on and it's not going to come down because of some weird bug that just got introduced.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same in Kubernetes. You're like, oh, well, yeah, we want to be on the latest. Like, well, why? Like, what business value does that drive? And then even if it does, you're like, okay, so now you've upgraded and there was some wonky thing in the upgrade and now you need some, you know, etcd wizard that, it's like, yes, Google has a pile of them. So they fix that internally pretty easily. Like, but you don't. So what are you going to do now?
Fantastic. Well, Tyler, this is a great conversation. I appreciate you joining the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Next up, I get a chance to sit down and chat with one of my favorite co-hosts. Actually, you know, they're all my favorite. But I'm chatting with Lauren Malhoit at Malhoit on the Twitters today about open source software. Lauren, what have you been up to?
Well, first of all, I just want to say the rest of the hosts aren't going to listen to this, so
that's the thing. You won't get into the host like, hey, I listened to that last episode, man, and I didn't appreciate the intro you did right before you talked to Lauren. I think you're right on that one. I think you're dead right on that.
No, but I've not been up too much, actually. Cisco Live last week, so everyone's kind of taking a week off and relaxing, and I'm just kind of trying to dive into some tech stuff so I don't completely lose that, as we've talked about before.
Yeah, are you nursing your hangover, Lauren?
I'm finally over it. I think I've
excellent.
Finally overcome it, yeah, a week later.
Yeah, I always think, never again, and then somehow I wake up in the morning and go, oh, yeah, that just happened.
That's right.
So fun fact for me is that I used to work in the Broadcom building. So I work for a smaller company, so we only have like one floor in a big building. Nope. Not big enough yet to have our logo on the side like your company, Lauren. You know, I think you work for a pretty big company, don't you? I've heard of them. Cisco?
Few buildings,
somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so now we've been taken over. I was in the Broadcom building, but now I'm in the Red Hat building apparently.
Oh,
so
cool.
I don't know. I feel like it's kind of a cool open source upgrade that just happened just kind of randomly right before. It wasn't planned. I didn't plan it with Red Hat to put their logo on the side of my building just so I could make this announcement on today's open source show. But I figured it was serendipitous. So I give Red Hat a little thank you for that. Thanks, Red Hat.
Not that I would ever want to leave Cisco, but I would definitely consider going. I think Red Hat's a pretty cool company.
It's cool. And they're going to be just upstairs from us now. So I'll be able to say hi to the Red Hat folks, you know,
nice.
On a regular basis. So there was something fun, actually. Speaking of open source software, do you like that transition, Lauren, how I just did that? speaking of open source software, there's this really fun thing that just came out. I guess, I don't know if you know this, but not only was it 4th of July, but it was also Canada Day. I'm not sure if you know this, Lauren, it's Canada Day, and part of Canada Day, GitHub apparently celebrated and launched Open Source Fridays. I'm not exactly sure if there's any beer involved that wasn't part of the announcement, but I imagine it's open to interpretation. And it's really just sort of a call to action. It's not really a national holiday, so I don't think Congress is moving on that anytime soon. Anybody and anyone who's a fan of open source, likes open source, getting involved in open source, just go ahead and, you know, throw your hat in there, start helping out. And one of my, I think the interesting point that they bring up over there at the GitHub was that you don't just have to be a coder to contribute to open source. And I thought that was a great point. And I like to sort of you know, let everyone know as well. And documentation is one really big thing I think they need help with over there. And there's a lot of other parts of the project too. What do you make of this open source Friday thing, Lauren? And does it matter whether or not there's beer involved?
Well, I think when we're talking about developers or developer adjacent people, there's always beer involved. That's what I've learned throughout.
I think that's a safe bet. I think you're right.
In-depth research.
Yeah, that's your market surveys that you've done.
Yes, but I think that's really cool. And like you said, it's a daunting task when you are especially getting started, I think, in the development world. Maybe you're an ops person, or maybe you're just getting started out early in career, to go through someone else's code and have the audacity to, you know, make bug submissions and try and make commits and whatnot, depending on how truly open it is. But to go through the documentation, I think, is probably a great way to learn development strategies and how the code maybe is working and figuring that out. But also, I think documentation in any sort of tech-related thing, product or solution, is always severely lacking. I mean, point me to a good documentation site and, you know, well, just good luck, quite frankly. So I think that's a great way to meet in the middle on both sides. So it's a learning experience, but also, you know, the open source community gets good documentation out of it. So that's pretty cool to me.
And actually, to be fair, I should probably make a addendum in that the Open Source Friday is actually a structured program for contributing to open source, not just so much a willy-nilly call to action. It's actually a cool blog that they put out for it. So take a look at that for that on the GitHub site with regards to sort of what it is. And there's a basically a set of best practices they put together, which was really nice to kind of help people understand how to contribute and what the best ways to contribute. And one of the cool things I think is how to build communities, because I think there's a lot of people that are good, you know, maybe good coders or maybe good at, you know, checking for bugs or even good at, you know, doing documentation. But I think what's missed sometimes is that, you know, it's not just this natural muscle that we all have to create communities to sort of build momentum around a project to get people involved and to get people excited. And so maybe cheerleaders, best practice for cheerleading. It's not on the blog site, but I think it's under building community. But best practice for code cheerleading, I think that'd be a good blog post there. Maybe a white paper.
Yeah, that's kind of an awesome way to think of it. And, you know, of course, you being so good at community, go to that, and I go directly to how good it would look on like my resume, how much I've contributed.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, and we all kind of need to market ourselves. It's funny, Keith Townsend actually brought up this great thing on LinkedIn about marketing yourself and making sure that you are, you know, you do what you say you do or what people think that you say you do. It's really interesting how we kind of have to sort of not like, you know, market yourself particularly, but you know this doesn't relate to open source at all, but I'll tie it back, don't worry, I'm getting there. but that we do have to kind of create that perception of, you know, this is what we're doing, constantly broadcast what we're doing, and that actually does tie back to building community, because when you have that muscle and you constantly flex it and you're constantly saying, hey, look, there's this great project I'm working on, hey, it's really good, hey, this is what I'm working on, it doesn't have to be actually so much about, you know, about you or about what you're doing, it's more about, hey, here's how you can get people to step forward or raise their hand, because people have crazy, crazy busy lives and they kind of need you to be in their face, like kind of jumping up and down about something so they can actually get excited about it, because people get a billion emails and billion DMs and there's billions of blog posts out there, and you kind of have to help, you know, them sift through the noise and kind of say, hey, look, there's this really cool project, or hey, you know, I need you to help, you know, fix bugs on, you know, or would you be great if you committed, or it would be great if you worked on documentation. So I think it's cool that GitHub's, you know, creating a special holiday, though not yet a national holiday, but maybe I can fax my congressman about that.
Government is going towards the open source effort. I know as of last year they were trying to have everything be 20% open source. So you never know. Maybe they'll embrace this and go for it.
Excellent. And along those lines too, there was another great article out by Tech Republic. Thanks to Matt Essay, writer over there for that. But it's about open source documentation. The title is "Open Source Documentation is Bad, but Proprietary Software is Worse." And one of the great stats he opens up with is just like, is that like almost 100% of people who are working in open source say that there's incomplete or confusing documentation. I mean, it's like a really high, it's like 97% or something like that, or maybe 93%. Right. That's the exact stat, 93%. And I think it's really telling that. And I think that's one of the reasons GitHub's really kind of, you know, blowing the bullhorn on this one is because they need help with documentation. So anyone out there listening to this, you don't have to be a coder. You can actually be just somebody who likes making documentation, and you can be there.
There are those out there.
But as Matt also talks about, that proprietary software is not so enticing, especially to coders. I mean, coders want instant access. They want instant feedback. They want to be able to go in and really start trying it right away without having the commitment and the POC and, I don't know, talk to a sales rep. The salespeople always want to talk to you.
Right.
And so the proprietary software thing is definitely a lot tougher because you got to get someone to hand over something to you. But with open source, you could just start working on it right away and trying it out. And I think that's really appealing.
Yeah, I've read some other things too, you know, especially around security and bug fixes and how, you know, a company only has a finite number of developers to work on a product. So when you open that up to an entire community, the theory is, and has been proven sometimes, I'm sure it's open to interpretation as well, but, you know, the wider the community, the more patches, the more bug fixes, the more security flaws you're going to see come up and actually get resolved. Rather than, you know, if a finite team's just trying to work on something. And, you know, a lot of teams, I was actually listening to Packet Pushers recently, and they pointed out that a lot of companies, you know, bonus their developers based on new features and, you know, getting customer asks in rather than creating secure, stable code, right?
Yeah, it's pretty common. I see that as well. Open source. Yeah.
So open source might be actually more secure and more stable eventually.
Eventually. You know? Yeah, more hacking. I mean, anyone can, like, I like to use this analogy when it comes to open source software and sort of that broad base of coders that you're talking about. And that's if, like, you create, like, a document, you know, just like a one page or two page or something like that, anything, or a PowerPoint presentation. If you and, like, one other person work on it, it'll be pretty good. You know, especially if you're really good at PowerPoint or creating, you know, nice looking documentation. If you have 1,000 people working on it, and of course there's got to be good governance and all that other stuff, that's going to be really, really good. And you know there's not going to be any typos. There's going to be no typos, all the right words. You're not going to use right. on-premise instead of on-premises. All that stuff's going to be fixed.
Right.
And I think that's the same with coders. You just, if you have a larger team, and the governance too has been tough. And we talked to a few people even on the show about things like the Linux Foundation and how it was tough to kind of create that first big governance structure. But I think people like GitHub have really gotten it down and really created a fantastic way to govern a large number of people committing and come out with a really great, and like you said, more secure, more complete product where people aren't just fighting for, you know, jamming in features so that they can maximize, you know, comp.
Right, yeah. It's a good way of, too, of, you know, you mentioned governance, but, you know, not everything should be committed right away. So being able to submit, you know, and have things checked over and do all that, you know, allowing the different, I guess, restrictive rules depending on what the code is and what you want people to do with it, I think is probably
a good thing that you mentioned earlier, which was how open is the project? And I like that idea of, and I can't remember who else was bringing it up, but they were saying how open is open? Because it is, there's all these different degrees and people say, oh, it's open source. And people also say, well, you got to be careful because it's free. There's a difference between free speech and free beer. And some communities are tighter, you know, more tightly controlled. They've got more governance rules in place. And so I think that's a really good point for people to kind of take a look at when, you know, when they're looking at getting involved is, you know, how fluid, you know, do they want the community to be? And I think that's probably part of the whole community building thing too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lauren, it was great chatting with you again about open source. Lots of fun things to think about. And I wish you all the best of luck on your future open source Fridays.
Yeah, thank you. You too. Maybe we'll have like an In Tech We Trust like sub-crew.
Yeah, there'll be, let's have an open source Friday podcast where, you know, we're all drinking beer.
Hey, there you go.
There won't be any coding, though. There will be no coding. No editing. Maybe some documents.
No coding, no editing.
Exactly. All right. Thanks, Lauren.
All right. Thanks.
And that's our show for this week. Research for this podcast was powered by Sprinklr, the social media management platform. To find out more about them, you can go to sprinklrwithnoe.com. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice and leave us a review if you will. It helps others find us. Also, we love hearing from you, the listeners, your story ideas, your thoughts on the tech world, and what you're doing as well, so that we can make this show as relevant to your daily tech life as possible. So hit us up on Twitter using hashtag InTechWeTrust. We'll be checking that daily to start conversations, engage with people, and get your thoughts. You can also follow us at InTech_WeTrust and give us your thoughts there as well. See you next time.